Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello, my name is Stephen Schaefer, and I'm excited to bring you a spectacular interview with Dr. Amy McDevitt. Dr. McDevitt is an associate professor in physical therapy at the University of Colorado. In addition to being a professor, Dr. McDevitt holds many other titles. She is both a board-certified orthopedic clinical specialist and a fellow of our academy. She is also a practicing clinician at the University of Colorado Health Sports Physical Therapy and Rehabilitation Clinic in Denver, Colorado. As if those accomplishments weren't enough, Dr. McDevitt has also participated in a plethora of different research activities involving a wide range of topics. We invited Dr. McDevitt to the podcast to discuss one of her recent papers, which is titled Thoracic Spine Thrust Manipulation for Individuals with Cervicogenic Headache, a Crossover Randomized Clinical Trial. I'd also like to take a moment to mention her co-authors on this project, which included Joshua Cleland, Daniel Rohn, Rebecca Altick, Drew Courtney, Paul Glynn, and Paul Mintgen. At the time of our recording, this paper had not yet been assigned a volume or issue number, but it was published online by the Journal of Manual and Manipulative Therapy in July of 2021. As per usual, we'll link to the publication in the show notes. And with that as our introduction, let's get to the interview. Dr. McDevitt, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we are honored to have you here today. And quite frankly, you're a strong and consistent figure within manual therapy. So it's a bit surprising to me that it's taken this long to have you on the show. But regardless, you're here now and I'm excited about the conversation. And speaking of which, let's just dive right in. And we'll start by having you provide the audience with a little bit of a background on the statistics as they relate to how large of a problem different headache types happen to be for people.
So thank you, Steve. Thanks again for having me. I'm happy to be here and to share a little bit of the information surrounding our study and some of the results. So to answer your question, a little bit of background, what we included in our article is that the worldwide lifetime prevalence of headache is about 96%. And about 46% of adults worldwide currently suffer from an active headache disorder. But as we all know, there's all sorts of different types of headaches. So there's migraine and cervicogenic and tension type headaches. But if we really just dial into cervicogenic headaches, that comprises about 20% of those individuals overall that have headache complaints. And I guess I would also venture to say that for many of us who sat behind computers during the pandemic, we may have actually even experienced a bit of cervicogenic headaches ourselves. So that's more or less the overall prevalence.
So as our audience probably already knows, this is a massive problem. And I think that's why it's so important for the profession, in particular because not just physical therapists, but more specifically manual physical therapists are positioned ideally to address this huge patient population.
I agree. I think as manual therapists, we're really perfectly positioned to treat individuals with cervicogenic headache. And in fact, cervicogenic headache is included in our clinical practice guidelines. So we should absolutely be treating these individuals as we see them present to us in our clinics.
Speaking of how we treat the patient, can you talk a little bit about the theoretical link between the thoracic spine, the cervical spine, and headaches? Of course, in this particular instance, cervicogenic headaches.
Sure. You know, I think this is a pretty classic example of regional interdependence. And we know that thoracic kyphosis and or hypomobility in the CT region, so the cervical thoracic region, can impact shoulder function, for example. And that's been well documented by Norlander and colleagues from previous studies on regional interdependence. And we also are more familiar with the relationship between the thoracic spine and the cervical spine. So really, we believe this work is just furthering the argument for regional interdependence due to the speculation that cervicogenic headaches probably arise from cervical dysfunction.
That's very interesting. And of course, I'm also familiar with the research on the thoracic spine as it relates to the shoulder. But one of the reasons this study, the current study that you have just had published, stood out to me is because of the fact that it's taking that regional interdependence in terms of cervicogenic headaches a little bit further. And bearing that in mind, can you describe to our audience how this particular study is unique in terms of its design as it relates to the evidence that's come before it?
Sure. You know, I think the study was really designed in order to determine if we could observe and measure some effects of treating the thoracic region, you know, specifically through thoracic manipulation on headache, pain, neck pain, and disability. We already know, and prior studies have shown improvement in cervicogenic headaches with cervical manipulation and mobilization, but we actually just wanted to test this hypothesis a little further and see, you know, does thoracic manipulation impact cervicogenic headaches as measured by pain and disability? Because there really overall, there's less inherent risk associated with treating the thoracic spine than the cervical spine. And we just wanted to see, you know, what are the results if we just isolate the thoracic spine without including cervical intervention? What does that look like in this population?
That's such an interesting research question, and I'm certainly glad and grateful that you conducted this study. But before we go further into the study itself, can you define for us or describe to us what definition of cervicogenic headache you used and why in particular you chose that definition? Because as our audience might already know, different people have provided different definitions for this diagnosis.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. We really looked at more of a classic definition that's embraced not just by physiotherapists, but by the medical community. And that definition is that it's a secondary disorder in which pain is referred from the neck and perceived in one or more areas of the head or the face. So if we further this definition, we're going to find that there are some criteria that need to be included and really in order to definitively determine, are we dealing with a cervicogenic headache or are we dealing with something else? Because oftentimes we see that sometimes these headaches actually overlap. You know, we see patients that have migraine headaches, but they may also have this component of a cervicogenic headache. So if we kind of further this definition, this is really what helped develop the inclusion criteria. So we included individuals that had a primary complaint of a headache, but it was exacerbated by neck movement or posture. So maybe sustained sitting posture or standing postures. And then to include them in the study as having a probable cervicogenic headache, we had to do the rest by exam. So we had to confirm, did they have a unilateral headache or a unilateral dominant headache? Did they present with joint tenderness and peripheralization into the head in at least one of the upper three cervical segments? And that was assessed by basically a posterior to anterior provocation with manual palpation. And then we were also looking for a headache frequency of one time per week for at least 2 months. Realize though that in the medical community to further this, they include diagnostic injection. So they inject some of the upper cervical facets in order to determine whether or not that can provoke a headache. And of course, as physical therapists, we're limited in our capabilities. So that was not a criteria that we were able to include in this study.
I think that sounds like an excellent choice of diagnostics from the combination of the symptom presentation plus the physical exam variables, which is very consistent with not only my knowledge of the literature, but how I practice in the clinic. And I can completely empathize with your, I'm not sure if it's frustration, but that difficulty with dealing with the whole injection thing. I've always been, I don't know, maybe a bit confused or conflicted. I feel like I'm very well positioned as a manual therapist to diagnose, treat, and, you know, otherwise handle cervicogenic headaches. So it frustrates me some when the medical literature is using the injection as the diagnostic standard. I feel like, yeah, it's helpful. You inject these facet joints and the headache goes away and there's a diagnostic value there. Mm-hmm. But with my fingertips, I can do the exact same thing without actually having to use a medication. So I don't know. I wish that injection part wasn't in the available literature, but we can't change that. So we have to move forward with the things that we can work with.
You know, I agree with you, Steve, and it's interesting because I think as clinicians, as physical therapists, we're used to operating with one hand tied behind our back. You know, we aren't always privy to MRI results and imaging results or even radiographs at times. And so I think we really have to fall hard and lean into our diagnostic clusters and all the other tools that we have to attempt to definitively, you know, diagnose or hypothesize about a certain condition. So, you know, yes, it's frustrating, but at the same time, I think that's who we are. And I think we work with the tools that we have. And so in this case, we couldn't include that particular criteria, but we felt pretty confident with the other ones that we were able to use in order to determine whether or not the potential participants did in fact present with a cervicogenic headache.
I, for one, think you can be very confident that your methods were able to identify cervicogenic headaches. And if we can now move on from talking about the patients, who were the examining and treating clinicians in this particular study? And did you have any sort of attempt to try and make sure that they were performing techniques reasonably uniformly?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because it was a smaller sample size RCT, we were able to accomplish all of our recruitment at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. So we have 3 hospitals on that campus, multiple schools. And so there's really a vast array of employees that work on this campus. And so we recruited solely from this campus. The other clinician was Paul Minkin. So Paul Minkin and myself were the primary examination and treating therapists. So basically, the treatment therapist was blinded to the results of the examination. So we basically changed roles, you know, for each randomization. And in order to assure that uniformity, basically what we did is we performed all the techniques on another individual that was a PT and received feedback. And then Paul would perform all the techniques on me and I would perform all the techniques on him. And then we would provide feedback. So that was how we more or less tried to assure consistency. And part of that is if anyone's met Paul Minkin, he's about 3 times my size. So we had to make sure that we were at least somewhat, you know, uniform in our approach to manage the size and ultimately the strength discrepancy between the two of us. But we've done it before in a number of other studies. And so hopefully we were successful in creating some uniformity.
Well, and perhaps very importantly, for a few different reasons, you're both expert clinicians, you're both fellows of the academy, and you've worked together, as you mentioned, quite a bit. So there's already a consistency from a whole lot of different levels. So I'm sure it was relatively easy to try and fine-tune this one small variable to try and make sure that the treatments were similar.
Yeah, I do hope so. And I think that's always going to be a limitation, right? You know, you have different treating therapists in different studies, and you can only go so far to assure that you're going to have complete uniformity. But I agree. I think because we have a track record of working together, we're pretty aware of, you know, how we perform the techniques. And so we felt about as reliable as we could get.
And arguably, complete uniformity isn't even a good thing. If you have, whatever, let's just magically say 1,000 physical therapists read this study and then try to incorporate the knowledge into their clinical practice, they're not all going to be part of that uniformity. So we have to, I think, trust and expect the fact that physical therapists are not always going to be the same in the clinic, but that doesn't mean they can't necessarily use their version of the technique or their usage of that knowledge to move the patient forward in a positive fashion.
I agree. I think that's an important statement. And so we're looking at a study that was designed to be prescriptive, but of course the pragmatic pieces of how we are all unique in our ways of delivering interventions are ultimately going to, you know, be a part of that treatment package, whether we intend it to be or not. So I appreciate your comment.
And as we move further into talking about the study, can you describe what the treatment approach consisted of? And perhaps you already got into that a little bit with the testing, but take that further into the techniques that you used in order to try and effectively change the presence of cervicogenic headaches.
Sure. So the techniques that we used, essentially, we did want to isolate this to the thoracic region or the cervical thoracic region. And so we chose a thoracic, basically manipulation and mobility package that has been utilized before and well studied, and that includes a prior study that Paul and I were both involved in, and Josh Cleland, looking at thoracic manipulation for individuals with shoulder pain. So this package includes 6 high velocity techniques that are performed in various positions. And the appendix of the paper describes these in more detail using appropriate terminology. But essentially, we had a seated cervicothoracic technique, a seated midthoracic technique, and then we had 2 techniques in supine, a midthoracic and an upper thoracic, as well as a prone thoracic technique. And so we used the same package of techniques for every participant. And then this was followed by a supine thoracic mobility activity that's done over a foam roll. And so that was also consistent amongst all of the participants. I don't know if I mentioned this, but we also had a prone thoracic extension bias technique. So we use the same set of techniques on everyone. And that's why the treatment therapist was blinded to the examination findings, because we didn't want to go in with any bias as far as what levels or what areas maybe the examination therapist perceived as being hypomobile. We just wanted to deliver the same package pretty much to every participant who was enrolled in this study. And so the treatment occurred 1 time a week for 4 weeks for a maximum of 6 sessions.
And was the first treatment done on the same day that the examination was completed?
It was. So for the participants that randomized into the treatment group, their treatment started on day 1. For those that were randomized into the hold group, they held for 4 weeks, and then they came back after the end of the 4 weeks, and they crossed over and then became the treatment group. So this particular study was actually a pretty traditional crossover design.
And if you're just doing the manipulation techniques, that doesn't take very long to implement. So approximately how long was each session?
So that's a great question. Each session was really only about 15 to 20 minutes. So that included the thoracic manipulation package and then patient education on the thoracic mobility. And some would argue, you know, we know that a multimodal approach is better. So why didn't you do more robust strengthening or education? And again, we know that the multimodal approach, treating the cervical spine and including exercise, is advantageous to utilize for people with cervicogenic headache. We really just wanted to look at thoracic manipulation, so high velocity techniques in isolation, just to see what that alone would do.
So in other words, you designed the study to answer a question that hadn't yet been answered, and you didn't want to muddy the waters by throwing in a bunch of other variables.
Exactly.
Well, that to me sounds like good scientific design and work, so congrats on that. I wish more people would put that type of thought into the studies before they conduct them. As I'm sure you're well aware, there are quite a few messy studies out there that when you read them, you just think to yourself, I'm not sure what I learned having just read this paper.
Yeah, I think it's hard. You know, there's this balance between coming up with a design and a study that is helpful in informing clinicians on how to approach the problem. And I think that really is the multimodal design. But again, sometimes the target is just answering a research question. And I think we really did want to know, what does this do just in isolation? Because, you know, we would never just approach treating an individual with cervicogenic headache with thoracic manipulation isolation. We've learned a lot over the past 10, 20 years about what is the most ideal way to approach individuals with musculoskeletal pain, and it certainly isn't one thing. So we already know that, and that's again why we decided, let's just look at this in isolation and see what the power of it is. We didn't want to add in too many layers of treatment to the cervical spine or strengthening, endurance, scapular stabilization, because we already know that those, according to the clinical practice guidelines, those should already be a part of that plan of care.
And when you implemented the techniques and then came back to look at the results, what was it that you found from the application of these thrust techniques to the thoracic spine?
So as far as our results, our primary outcome measure was the headache disability inventory. The secondary outcome measures were the neck disability index, so the NDI, and the numeric pain rating scale, the NPRS, and then the global rating of change. The headache disability inventory ended up being the wrong outcome measure, to be honest. And so this is really why I now believe that pilot studies are so important because we wanted to come up with a way to really just look at some of those symptoms associated with cervicogenic headache. So with the headache, but the headache disability inventory had never been used with this population before, but it really retrospectively now we realize that it's really meant for individuals with migraine headache. So using that as our primary outcome measure was more or less a bust. But when we looked at the others, so the NDI, the NPRS, and the Global Rating of Change, 4 weeks was really our main time point of interest because that's the time when the treatment group had been completed and the hold group had not started yet. And so they were still truly serving as a control. So the HDI slightly favored the treatment group, but it wasn't significant at all. If we look at the NDI and the NPRS scores, those were significant, favoring treatment at 4 weeks. And to complement that, participants who did receive the treatment right away did have greater odds of reporting a meaningful change with the global rating of change. And our benchmark was a +4 for that. So at 8 weeks, everyone had already received the treatment. And so we didn't really expect there to be differences between groups at 8 weeks and 3 months. And sure enough, there weren't differences. Because again, this is a crossover trial. So the main point that we're looking to measure is that 4 week point. So that's after the treatment group had completed their treatment and before the hold group would start their treatment. So that's essentially it. So we did see some optimistic results with the NDI, NPRS, and the global rating of change.
Based on those positive results, what's your best advice to physical therapists or even manual physical therapists in terms of how they might incorporate the knowledge learned from this study into their clinical practice?
Sure. So I think the results of this study should be considered. However, manual therapists really, in my opinion, need to incorporate the clinical practice guidelines and the best evidence into their clinical practice. So I do believe that, you know, even though we like to be optimistic about our own work, I think we have to be cautious with a RCT such as this one that really had a small sample size. But due to the perception of less threat and improved safety when performing manipulation or high velocity techniques to the thorax or thoracic spine versus the cervical spine, I would recommend incorporating thoracic manipulation, you know, into your multimodal treatment. But the caveat is this can't neglect other components of what the clinical practice guidelines are recommending, which include treatment to the cervical spine with mobility exercises, snags, cervical manipulation, mobilization, as well as strength, endurance exercises, and also stretching. So again, I'm cautious with making a recommendation because it's such a small sample, but I believe that we were able to show that there potentially is some impact by utilizing thoracic manipulation. But I would say in addition to the other things that we know we need to include based on what the clinical practice guidelines are telling us.
I think that sounds like very solid advice. And of course, it's always a good idea to have a solid awareness of the research so that you can incorporate it into your clinical practice. And just based on what you've said today, I can imagine in my head multiple potential follow-up studies to the one that you just conducted. But I asked the following question in a very general sense, because just because there's a reasonable or logical follow-up doesn't mean it needs to be conducted. What projects are you currently working on? And I know there's probably more than one in terms of exciting research that we can see coming out of your work and your co-author's work in the forthcoming months or years.
Well, I think as far as this project is concerned, I think we are going to plan a secondary analysis of some of the examination data. I think one thing we did well is we included a really robust physical examination. And so we may want to further analyze and see if there's a way to attempt to classify some of the examination data in order to better understand the condition. That's one thing that I think we are planning is a secondary analysis. Some of the other work kind of coming down the pipeline, I'm completing a PhD through the University of Newcastle. And so that dissertation is surrounding treating anterior shoulder pain. And so in the next year or so, I've been working on a couple projects with Josh Cleland and Suzanne Snodgrass, really in the realm of a scoping review and a Delphi study in order to better understand certain components of anterior shoulder pain. But, you know, I still think these types of clinical research studies are important just to continue to inform us and inform the clinical practice guidelines. And so, you know, as we move forward and as we update clinical practice guidelines, I think it's important to keep some of these trials going that help us just further understand this concept of regional interdependence and best practice for treating things like neck pain, which includes cervicogenic headache.
Those all sound like great projects, and I look forward to seeing them published in the future. And if I may say so, Dr. McDevitt, it has been a great pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for all of your contributions to the clinical realm, to teaching, and of course, especially to research. We greatly appreciate all of your work, and, you know, just on behalf of the profession, thank you.
Thank you to you for doing the podcast series for AMT, and also thank you to Cardon and for AMT, because this study would not have been possible without a grant that was given to us by Cardon Rehab and through the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. So we are really grateful for the Academy, because that really fueled and provided the funds for us to be able to complete this study. So we are eternally grateful. Thank you so much.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.